This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Welcome to the award-winning Interest in Health and Safety podcast, making health and safety as important as everything else we do in business. And now your host, health and safety specialist, mentor and speaker, Colin Nottage.
Hi there, it's Colin Nottage here and welcome to the Interest in Health and Safety podcast. Sometimes, you know, you just meet people and they're just smashing, and that's who we've got on today. In actual fact, we've got these guys on for the next three episodes. We've got David Gold, and David is American. He's a founder and managing director of Gold Necked Associates, based over in Switzerland. And it's just so knowledgeable. He brings up this story of helping divers in Thailand, and I'm going to get him back on to talk about that in a lot of detail. I've also got Stuart Hughes, and Stuart is just one of the nicest people I've ever met. He's so sincere. He's just a lovely person, and he heads up the health and safety for Mercedes Formula One Grand Prix, which is probably the coolest job in the world. Anyway, they've done some work. They've actually written a paper all about COVID and the impact that it's had on our profession, and we sort of talk about it. To be fair, the first episode is them introducing themselves and talking about their lives and their history, which is really, really fascinating. And then we're going to go into the second episode, which is exploring the paper. And then the third episode is the one that I'm most excited about, because that's their blue sky thinking. And I have a little bit of an input into it, but their blue sky thinking on on the way forward for our profession. So I'd like to introduce you to David and Stuart.
Good morning, gents. How are you all this morning?
Great. Thank you. Thank you for inviting us onto this forum.
Really. For the benefit of the listeners to the podcast, I'd love you to properly introduce yourselves to our listeners. So maybe starting with yourself, David, could you just give us a little bit of a background of who you are?
Okay, I'm Dave Gold. I'm a safety and health professional, and I've been in the field of occupational safety and health for more than 40 years. I originally come from, you could probably tell from my accent, I originally come from Boston, in the United States, but I've been living and working out of Switzerland for 35 years. I kind of entered the profession in a funny way, but I think most professionals have also entered the profession in a funny way. I was a firefighter paramedic in the United States, and I saw a lot of accidents, and I treated a lot of accidents, not only workplace accidents, but vehicular accidents and other types of situations. And also saw some rather critical situations where fires had consumed factories in a variety of different locations. And I decided that rather than treating people all the time, that we need to turn this around a little bit, and we need to kind of focus on prevention. So I started to get involved in occupational safety and health. At that point in time, I had a master's degree in occupational education, and decided to use education as a tool to strengthen occupational safety and health. And at the same time, I moved into the area from being a street paramedic to actually training paramedics and training occupational doctors and training others working for the state of New Hampshire and the state of Maine, and kind of segued into the idea of, okay, I'm going to set up an organization. I'm going to set up a company. It was called at that point in time Safety Education Associates. It was in the early 1980s. And the idea was to start educating people from the employer to the worker and everybody in between on how to deal with occupational safety and health. And it was a great ride for 4 or 5 years that I had my own company at that point in time. And then I found myself, for family reasons, in Geneva, Switzerland. I was exploring a little bit where I could get multiple language versions of educational opportunities or educational packages that I could use in safety and health, and stumbled upon an organization called the International Labor Office, the ILO, which is a United Nations specialized agency. And literally, I came in at 7:30 in the morning. No one was there except the boss of the safety and health branch. I was told I had 10 minutes to talk to him and explain what I wanted. And 3 hours later, I emerged from the office with an offer of employment. Said I would stay for 6 months and ended up staying for 23 years. And at that point in time, I was the director of training and education worldwide in occupational safety and health. And it was really fascinating. And I was able to develop a deeper amount of knowledge in certain areas, such as diving safety, such as firefighter safety, such as chemical safety, areas that were quite important to the International Labor Office, but at the same time, important to me as well, and traveled around the world. In the 1990s, I was posted for 5 years in Bangkok, Thailand. And in Thailand, I was the chief technical advisor of a multi-million dollar technical cooperation project funded by the government of Finland. And during my tenure, we basically tried to strengthen information, education, and capacities of factory inspectors, trade unions, and employers in about 24 different countries in the Asia-Pacific region. The region basically stretched from Pakistan, you know, to the west, and Mongolia to the north, Fiji to the south, and into the Pacific, to basically build this capacity. At the same time, I decided I would do a PhD. And I was thinking about a variety of different areas, but because I was brought up on the sea and I was a man of the sea, I decided I would focus on what I heard about was the sea gypsies of Thailand, which are a group of indigenous fishermen divers who were dying of decompression sickness and air embolism and a variety of other things at an alarming rate. The rate of death was higher than the rate of death of construction workers on scaffolding in Bangkok, if you could imagine. Worked for 5 years with the sea gypsies. And I think the work that I did and the people that I worked with turned things around and ended up with my doctorate in occupational safety and health engineering. Came back, continued to serve the institution. It continued to serve the United Nations. And then it became also very interesting because I was immediately approached on returning that we have a problem. And that is the area of stress is emerging, but no one really knows anything about it. And I was asked, can you develop an educational program that we can look at the interrelationships of various psychosocial issues at the workplace and how we can break a negative synergistic effect of these issues, a negative spiral? And we were successful in implementing in 2002 what was called the SOLVE training program, mm-hmm. where we spread this to 43 different countries in multiple languages. And it wasn't just a question of going and teaching, it was a question of establishing the capacity of each country to be able to carry this out. Mm-hmm. And the SOLVE program still exists today within the UN. Left the UN, and shortly after I left the UN, I reopened a consultancy. Gold Connect Associates, which is still active, and also heard about the Institution of Occupational Safety and Health, which I joined about 10 years ago, and worked my way up through the ranks to the level of Chartered Fellow. Right now I'm serving in the capacity of a vice president of the institution. So that's a little bit my story. There's a lot of details I've left behind. It's been a fascinating journey. Would I do it again in the field of occupational safety and health? Absolutely. Would I change some things as I went? Maybe a few. I wouldn't change what I did in Thailand. I wouldn't change what I did in the UN. But I've enjoyed it. It's been a great ride.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, there's absolutely tons in there, and I'd love to get you back on and talk about that diving. Okay, but we're not talking about that today. Okay, but I'd love to talk about that in a bit more detail. But what I'd want to do before we go any further is introduce my other guest on the show, which is Stuart Hughes. Stuart, you know, we've known each other for probably about a year now, I suppose, something like that. And I'm absolutely blown away by what you do. But tell us a bit about who you are and, you know, now you've got to where you've got to.
You ever wish you got asked to do it first? Do you know what I mean? Colin, I love you to pieces, and I've enjoyed building our relationship over the last year. And I've known David for coming up to 3 years now, and he's a very valued mentor of mine and a great friend as well. And you know, I'm always in awe when I get to sit and hear about David's journey. And I definitely recommend you do get him back and talk about the Sea Gypsies and what David did in Thailand, because that's actually genuinely, you know, changed a whole group of people's prospects, livelihoods, and generally made like a significant impact on a community. And that, I think, fundamentally is what occupational safety and health is capable of. And it's a remarkable story. And David's a remarkable man. So, you know, it's really cool to hear all of that stuff. I think for, like, look, my journey's different and not as well traveled or as well trodden as David's, but I got into occupational safety and health through environmental health, really. So I left school, didn't really want to follow the path of everybody else to A levels, and, you know, I mean, if truth be known, I'd probably like gone to drama school and pledged my way to be an actor. But my dad was quite insistent I got a proper job, or a career at least. So I went off to Caitlin College, and whilst I was there, I got really, really interested in food hygiene and public health and microbiology and things that had a safety element to them. I had a really inspirational lecturer, and he used to be an environmental health officer. He basically taught us in Cockney rhyming slang. So I learned all of these different phrases, the old battle cruiser and apples and pears and all of this stuff. And he basically worked in the centre of London, knew everybody in all the market stalls, in all the restaurants, went to all these different places and, you know, essentially kept people safe. And that sounds pretty interesting. So went off to see a careers advisor, and they said, yeah, you know, you can go to university and do environmental health, and it covers all this stuff you've just told me you like. I was like, that's amazing. I'd never thought about going to uni. Like, when I was at college, I found out I was dyslexic, and I've never been, I suppose, I'd always done enough, I suppose, in learning rather than excelling at anything. But I loved it. It was part hard study. It was part vocational stuff. It did all of these weird and wonderful, you know, elements, food, you know, meat hygiene inspections, you know, abattoirs. And you learned all about environmental pollution and like crazy amounts of science stuff that took me quite a while to understand. But loved it. But during that, at uni, I fell in love with health and safety. I was like, fundamentally, I've got a belief that, you know, people shouldn't die for other people's profits, and that actually, you know, we can help people thrive in the workplace. Work can provide a lot of purpose. And yeah, I just thought, well, that could take me anywhere in the world. You know, that's a job I can go anywhere with, which, you know, when you're 19, 20, 21, you're all excited about that kind of stuff, aren't you? You want to go wherever you do. So left uni, went into environmental health, went and worked down at Camden Council and Westminster Council, and my stripes, I suppose, as you'd probably call it. Did enforcement work across both of those areas. And then council paid for me to do my NEBOSH, and that was really cool. Really enjoyed that bit of that study as well. Got more into, you know, nothing specific, just really like the general concepts around safety. And I suppose some of the, I always kind of consider myself as a generalist rather than, you know, having any great specialism in one area. And I like to pull specialists in and, you know, in to help me solve problems. And it was that problem solving element that I think I really enjoyed. And the fact you got to talk to, you know, people at all levels throughout all organisations, and that was really what set it off for me. And then I wanted to get into high risk industry, so went into waste management. Really interesting environment there. And then whilst I was there, I got an opportunity to go to KPMG and do consultancy work across audit, mergers and acquisitions, and all kinds of just different elements. I did marine safety and ports, and a really good experience, but I don't think I was culturally a fit for that environment. But I learned a lot from it. But I guess I realized that when I left, and now I sit as head of health and safety for Mercedes Formula One, which, like, you know, I watched it with my dad and my granddad as a little boy, loved F1, always, you know, wanted to get into it, I suppose, but never thought it was a reality. And it was through occupational safety and health, and who would have known that? So, you know, for a career journey, it's pretty cool. Always comes the question of what next, which is always a challenge at some point, but that time will come. And like David, I got to a point where I wanted to do a bit more for the profession, I suppose. So it's got an image problem, really, safety. It's got a bad reputation, and I wanted to be part of a sea of change for that. So I joined the Performance Development Committee with IOSH to try and help influence some change there and get some experience. And through that opportunity, was able to apply for the vice president position, and was fortunate enough to be voted in by my peers 2.5 years ago. And we have really enjoyed that journey so far with them. There's still a lot of work to do. But yeah, that's it really. I went from catering college to Formula One, basically, is the short version of that.
I must admit, I mean, I just love, you know, I'm sitting here in a room with somebody that's influenced diving in Thailand and somebody that's influencing Formula One around the world. And it's just absolutely beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. But how did you guys meet then? How did you get together?
It's an interesting one. So basically we met at the kind of presentation stage for the vice president interviews. So we were up at the Grange. We'd done the hard yards of the filling out of the forms and the interview questions and everything else. Then you have to go and present to council. And it's a knockout competition, basically. There were six of us and there was three positions, and two for 3 years and one for a year, if I remember correctly. And there was a little bit of nervousness waiting outside, prepping, probably a bit of pacing. I had a chat with David because we you know, everyone's out there waiting to go in and do their slot. But obviously went in. I'd done my presentation. We got the results. David and I were successful. And we've both got a mutual friend in Andrew Sharman. So he'd kind of just said, you know, you two are my buddies, you know, you're going to get along with each other. And then also suggested to me that, you know, David did some mentoring for me. And, you know, we've built that relationship over the last 2.5 years to, you know, well beyond the, you know, a mentor-mentee relationship. I value David as a really good friend. Had me at his house in Geneva and sailed me across the lake, which was, you know, a beautiful experience. And if you ever want to understand how to host somebody in the most amazing way, David's wife is impeccable at that. Like, Marianne is a phenomenal powerhouse of a lady, and I've never felt so welcome. And it's just things like that that, you know, I've got a lot of respect for the things that David has done, for his experience. And I think that it's really important, you know, for the younger generations that come through that want to implement change, that you understand whose shoulders you're standing on. And I think it's also really important that, you know, we take as much knowledge and experience from people that have been there before as we can. And, you know, also help as well, because there's, you know, Dave is a fellow within IOSH, and he's got all of this stuff to be able to give back. And, you know, the sea of change that's been there through David's career, it is amplified through mine, and for the generation behind me will be amplified again and again and again as the world gets more, you know, ambiguous and complex and challenging, and, you know, the rate of change is rapid, and I will need help navigating through that. Mm-hmm. And what I want to be able to do in the same way that Dave has done for me is to be able to talk to that next generation of safety professionals, to be able to, you know, help share some of the learnings and experiences, some of the mistakes we've, you know, I've made, and you know, help guide, but also like harvest from them and go, right, what is all this new fangled technology, or what is all of this, like what is that kind of next bit of thinking, and how can I learn from that and incorporate that into what I do? And that, you know, in a very short space of time, I've been able to do that with David. He's really, you know, he's too humble. So, you know, he spoke about his doctorate, but like, I've read it. It's incredible, right? He gave me signed copy. I've read it. He wrote a lovely message in the front of it. Like, you know, like just a, you know, David does things properly. And it's amazing what he's done. And he's what he's really helped me with is like break some of the barriers down to academia for me. So I'm always put off by it, I'm put off by language, by the complexity of it, by, you know, if I pick up a paper and it's got like 500 references, I'm already intimidated a bit because I'm like, someone's read like a mind-boggling amount of stuff. And he's helped break down some of those barriers for me, and in such a way that we've actually done, you know, a paper together. And I know we're going to talk about that later, Colin, but it's like that's the power of what you can do when you build those relationships. And it's been, yeah, I'm eternally grateful for it. And, you know, I'm sure David will tell you he's taken some stuff away mutually in the other way around of the relationship, but it's been a, you know, a real privilege to do that. And we wouldn't have done it if we weren't both people who want to make a difference for the OSH profession. And that's you know, you attract people, don't you? And you end up in situations where people are like you or have the same ambitions or ideas. Might not always see eye to eye, you might not always agree with absolutely everything, but you end up in the same environment. And that's what happened to us, and we've taken that opportunity.
I really hope, David, that you actually do now say that you, yeah, I've actually got something from my relationship with Stuart. He's muted. He's got, here we go. Here he is.
Yeah, you know, I talked about the negative synergistic effect of multiple psychosocial issues, and the word synergy is something, you know, very, very important to me. And with Stuart, since I've known him, we have developed a phenomenally positive synergy. Stuart referenced the fact that informally I've been mentoring him, but there's a little bit of an inaccuracy in that, because we have forged ourselves as a team and as a star team. In fact, I find navigating through some of the bureaucracies that we've navigated through, having Stuart as my wing person and me being Stuart's wing person from time to time, I find that synergy, that teamwork, that is very, very important, because a team has to have a common sort of goal, you know, just like a soccer team, or you would say a football team. You know, you have these goalposts out there, and then hopefully the goalposts don't move too much over a period of time. But you need to work in that direction. And with Stuart, we've been able to do it. Now, one of the things that I find is also interesting, back in 1986, Bro Harlan Brundtland, who was the Prime Minister of Norway, later to become the Director General of the World Health Organization, started to talk about this idea of sustainability. she started to talk about this idea of how do we move forward in this generation to make sure that we don't impact negatively on the next generation so that we can do something in a very, very positive way. And this whole idea of sustainability, and there's environmental sustainability, economic sustainability, and social sustainability. When I think if you would look at a bond between Stuart and myself, it's social sustainability. You know, it's working with people to strengthen their ability to protect themselves in the environment, to look at the human capital in a very, very positive way. And I think for Stuart and myself, occupational safety and health is indeed a profession where that can be done if we pull the right levers or push the right buttons in the right way. And it's not a question necessarily of ignoring certain things. It's not a question, for example, of saying safety first. It's more a question of putting safety out there and saying safety has to be integrated in everything that's being done. And equally important, health has to be integrated into everything that we do in the workplace. Yeah. And sharing these ideals, sharing or building this synergy, it's a positive spiral in my mind that strengthens both of us. And, you know, and Stuart and I have been in situations where, you know, we've been sailing a boat and I say, okay, Stuart, you're going to take the tiller. Okay. And he takes the tiller and he steers the boat. And in a sense, that's our relationship. We go back and forth in different ways. We give each other opportunities. We talk about different things. We talk about things in our personal life. We talk about things in our professional life. But, you know, and I'm not a racing car driver. You know, I love the sea and I love the mountains. You know, I want to see a sailboat go fast, but, you know, not necessarily competitive. We have our differences, but more importantly, there are certain things that bind us in a very positive relationship. So I have nothing but very positive things to say about Stuart. Mm-hmm. And our relationship, and you know, hopefully over the years this relationship will continue to grow wherever life takes us, but it's you know, I consider Stuart first and foremost a friend, and secondly but less importantly a colleague, but we are collegially working in the same direction.
It's lovely. I mean, I'm just sitting here with a massive smile on my face, and it just, you know, it just feels so warm. You know, the relationship that you have is so warm, and it's lovely. And I think from that, you know, that gives you the power to actually do something really amazing. And, you know, and I think, you know, I can feel it in both of you that's what you want to do. You want to help shape the future from a professional point of view. And I suppose that leads nicely into the paper that you published back in November last year, November 21. Let me just read it out. The perceptions, experiences, and opportunities for occupational safety and health professionals arising out of the COVID-19 pandemic. So that's something. Just tell me a little bit what, you know, how did you go about actually, you know, deciding that you actually wanted to put a paper together to begin with, and then how do you go about, you know, sort of, you know, deciding what you actually want to be on?
This is David's bag in the thing, but we were first of all, I feel like we're like Maverick and Goose now, David, with the wingman reference. I'm down with the Top Gun element, and then secondly, I'm just to clarify, I'm definitely not a racing driver, despite what some people who've been in a car might tell you. But the truth is, we were I was visiting David in Geneva, and you know, we'd spoken about, you know, what are some of the things that we need to be what are some of the ways that we can influence, you know, the profession. And memory serves me, we might have even had the conversation kind of prior to the pandemic, you know, that how are we going to you know, move the occupational safety and health profession along. And I think when the pandemic came in, it became apparent that there was maybe three levels of where occupational safety and health was seen. Like the organizations that got it already were, you know, leaning heavily on their occupational safety and health people, and they knew the value of it, and they turned to them to direct them through the pandemic. And then there was the ones that were like, oh, crumbs, actually, we don't really know who to turn to, but it turns out occupational safety and health people are the people to turn to, and we're starting to realize the value. And then there was the others that just still didn't get it and put their safety people on furlough, and, you know, you kind of went, well, I wonder who's helping them get through this type scenario. And you could feel it. You could feel in conversation, in news, in discussion, in, you know, that IOSH linking up with the World Health Organization, you could feel a momentum shift. And it was like, right, we need to tap into that. We need to tap into, what are we going to learn? What are we going to learn from this? And how are we going to take that learning and communicate? And, you know, David and I had a conversation about actually, well, we're tapped into quite a lot of people, you know, across the globe that deal with this. So let's collectively get that. What are we seeing? What are we learning? What are we missing actually at the moment? What are we not aware of that's happening that would be helpful? And it was like, right, okay, how do we do it? So, well, let's get some focus groups together now. So just, you know, I can help with that element of it. You know, we can steer some conversations, ask some sensible questions, and let people talk to us. And that's what we started to do, around seven kind of key themes. And it was really an intelligence gathering for David and I, to work out how we could, you know, then what we'd do with that. But we didn't set out to do a paper. I think I might have run it. I might have run away if David had said we're going to do an academic paper at the start of it. And, you know, during that process, David said to me, like, there's a paper in this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd have never seen it, if I'm honest with you. Like, I wouldn't have joined those dots together. And David said, you know, he's a convincing gentleman. So he convinced me that there was a paper in it, and said, right, you know, I know how to do this, but I can't do it all on my own, and I need some help. And I said, well, I don't have a Scooby-Doo how to do this. I don't know where to start whatsoever, but I'm prepared to help, because I think, you know, we were really hearing some interesting things from people within the profession. And it was like, well, let's do it. And then I've kind of, you know, handed myself over into David's capable captaincy, really, and occasionally took the tiller when he asked me. You know, I didn't, I can't say, you know, it was, I drove that in any way, shape or form, but it was a really interesting mechanism to go out of that, right, well, we're going to go and get some learning to then turn that into the paper.
Mm-hmm. And David, did you feel that for it to have as bigger impact as it needed to have, then probably it needed to be turned into a paper? Is that why you saw it that way, or was there another reason why you thought there was some value for a paper?
Well, I'm gonna back up a little okay. Further. First of all, my thinking about academia, okay, and the publishing of papers, the importance of publishing peer-reviewed papers, is that these are mechanisms to examine a profession which is growing, and because of the pandemic, it's growing more rapidly than it was growing before. And not only look at the profession, but also look at the practices. And not only look at the practices, but to validate whether or not a practice is working in the right direction through the peer review process. And in my mind, as we move forward, this is a really, really critical thing to do. And as a professional, as an academic, I call myself an academic, even though I teach at university, but I'm not actively teaching at university right now. But I find that this whole concept of writing scientific or academic papers and putting them through this process and having it a blind peer review is a very, very healthy sort of thing to examine what we're doing and where we're going with it. In that regard, there was a paper that preceded the one that Stuart and I worked on. It was a paper, Stuart mentioned a third member of the Three Musketeers, if you like, or the dynamic trio, which was Stuart, myself, and Andrew Sharman. Mm-hmm. And with Andrew Sharman and another gentleman named David Thomas from Middlesex University, we looked at the role of the safety and health professional. And again, looking at the psychosocial stressors that emerged during COVID-19 as a comorbidity, or you know, a parallel sort of set of problems that exists along with the actual disease itself. And in fact, in 2 days ago, I received a message from a medical doctor, a physician in the United States named Tom Hicks, who's an occupational doctor who read these papers. And he said, you know, we're going to find that this comorbidity that you talk about, these psychosocial issues that were in the first paper, these are going to emerge in the future, perhaps as more important issues than COVID-19 itself. Mm-hmm. The physical disease will disappear, but the psychosocial issues that have been generated by that disease will not. Mm-hmm. So we did the first paper, just to put it into perspective for you, we did the first paper by going around the world and setting up webinars in a variety of different places to explore with safety and health professionals this negative synergistic effect so they would understand it. Mm-hmm. And based on that understanding, I came to the realization, and I discussed it with Stuart, that we need to go a little bit deeper. We need to focus a little bit more on certain issues. And these are issues that were also generated, even though they were there beforehand. These are also issues that were generated to a certain extent by COVID-19. In some situations, they were rather exacerbated by the situation with COVID-19. And one of the things I found striking the papers were written in the middle of COVID-19. And one of the things I found striking, for example, is there was an emergency department physician, emergency department doctor in the United States, based on all of the pressures and everything else, who went through a syndrome of burnout and eventually committed suicide as a result of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. I said to myself, the world of work, you know, and our profession needs to be able to work up front. We need to look ahead, not behind, and figure out how we can prevent this kind of thing from happening. We have to prevent these kind of tragedies. We have to prevent the negative synergistic effect of multiple psychosocial issues, but we need to look at other things as well. And therefore, the emergence of this paper, as Stuart was mentioning earlier, even though it has some antecedents before COVID-19, was trying to explore some of these issues. And what we decided to do was to try to select some key people, some leaders in safety and health. And we actually went, our principal selection was the people that were on the presidential team and the council of IOSH. And we actually picked some of these people to sit on different focus groups. Other people emerged into the groups as well. And I won't go into the details of the groups right now, because we'll do that, I guess, in the next edition. But the idea was to actually explore these issues. So if I go back to this emergency department physician who committed suicide, one of the things that we looked at were should we be addressing as safety and health professionals the issue of post-traumatic stress disorder, and how can we do it, and how do we explore it? So we spent an hour covering that, and we had six other issues where we actually looked at that in depth as well and came up with findings that went through the academic rigor to see where we're going. But one of the things that we kept thinking about, and our friend David Thomas actually spearheaded this thinking a little bit he kept pushing this issue for us, and he was absolutely correct. As a professor at Middlesex University, David basically said, well, what we're seeing through all of this is the profession is changing. The profession is emerging. We have to look at, for example, business continuity and resilience to not only COVID-19, but things that can happen in the future. And this paper, in some ways, segued our thinking into examining the future of the profession, where it's going, and what tools does the professional need, the safety and health professional need, to be able to address this kind of issue. It's not a question of simply observing a process and doing a risk assessment and putting forward control measures, which is a very, very valid tool for the profession, but it's thinking beyond that. It's working up into the C-suite and being able to talk intelligently with people on how we integrate safety and health into everything that we do.
I hope that
answered your question.
No. You really have, and I think it's such a fundamental part, a fundamental change that needs to be considered. I'd say a change. You know, there's a lot of people that are doing it. There's a lot of people that are really successfully out there, you know, doing exactly what you're saying. But there's also a lot of people that haven't got the skills and haven't got the knowledge and haven't got the understanding. And in a way, it can be quite daunting. You know, there's a lot of people that are practicing health and safety and maybe even don't get the opportunity to go and talk to the people that can really, really influence change. And because the role isn't seen as important enough almost, you know, I don't know.
Colin, it's a really important point, two bits in that, right? One is the scope creep in occupational safety and health, and you mm-hmm. get burdened with more and more and more and more and more. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think it's really important for OSH professionals to understand their own limitations and where they do need to go and get expertise and seek help and at what point, you know, they are what point they are the problem solver, what point they are the facilitator, what point they are the map to get people to where they need to be and where they're pulling in the expertise. And I think the other point is, sometimes you don't always have to go to the very top to make change. You can make small incremental changes around you that compound and eventually make that bigger change. But there is there's an opportunity now. And I think this is, one of the things that we found, through doing the research and through putting the paper out there and stuff, there is an opportunity to get to the top. There are opportunities to go and shout about the value of what the OSH professional does and how the profession influences the workplace. And I think that sustainability point that David referenced earlier, back from 1986, when I was only 3 years old, David. So, there's this kind of gives you the idea of the breadth of knowledge that David has there. But that sustainability point, like people in the heart of that is a really critical issue. And if we're talking about sustainability and we're talking about people and we're talking about the planet, and then we're talking about the economic elements of sustainability as well, that's where the conversation needs to come in the OSH profession. And it's one of the key things I think we have to do is help the OSH professionals to be able to align language into those environments, so that we're not going in and talking in acronyms and alien terms, but also there's an obligation on us to understand whether it's business or whether it's the charity sector or whatever it is that you're in, it is to understand how they talk about things, to understand the core purpose of the organization and actually the pressures and strains in there, to be able to go and have those conversations. Because it's very frustrating if you've got something important to say but you can't communicate it very well because you're at loggerheads with the people that are trying to receive your message because you don't understand the view from their side of the table. And that, I think, is a really important point there. But I think one of the big challenges is that knowing your own limitations. You can't do everything as an OSH professional, and a lot of the ones I know have that within them that they want to. Mm-hmm. And I think we carry I think the profession carries quite a big burden on its shoulders. There's a heck of a lot of responsibility in the roles, you know, particularly when if you're a QHSE director in a big global organization and you've got 10, 20,000 employees who all across the globe, like, it's massive, right? So this element that we talk about of the kind of, you know, the post-traumatic stress that Dave is talking about, and you know, actually, you know, how do we cope as a profession? How do we look after ourselves and care for ourselves as well, as well as the, you know, caring for the others in our care? And I think, like, it was just fascinating to hear, you know, people open up about these topics and really lay their vulnerabilities out of actually, like, I get to a point and I am confused, lost, don't know where to go with it. And actually to have those conversations of, well, is it our responsibility, or where do you pass that on to the people that do have that knowledge and experience? I just wanted to jump in on that, because it's a really important point, I think, that we sometimes miss in the bigger conversation.
And this concept, Stuart, of scope creep is interesting, and it's a bit of a challenge, because if we would lay out a map, if we would draw a mind map, as the Swedes like to say, of what is the occupational safety and health profession, not from a myopic point of view, but from a more of a global point of view. And occupational safety and health not only embraces the safety engineering, but it also embraces medical doctors, industrial hygienists, occupational psychologists, toxicologists, all kinds of different people, occupational nurses. And we have to be careful that we don't take an institutional perspective that is too narrow-minded. So the scope is absolutely massive. But we as individuals, and this becomes, I think, a very important point, we as individuals, what you were saying, need to know where we need to say, okay, we need to turn to someone else and get some help and figure what we can and we cannot do. I think a very interesting example of this is this concept of mental health first aid. Mental health first aid was originally developed by the World Health Organization to help people in developing countries. And then it became something that became, a lot of people have become mental health first aiders in the workplace. They may have different titles. They may have different ways of thinking about it. There may be certain stigmas associated with certain words, but there are a lot of people out there. But do they know their boundaries? Do they know that the job doesn't, like with first aid, the job never stops when you start to apply first aid. It stops when you turn it over to someone more competent than you are to deal with it. And with mental health first aid, are the mental health first aiders, do they know and understand that their job is to perhaps meet and greet people, to talk to them a little bit, to figure out where they can signpost, or if that's the right terminology in British English, where they can refer people to get the help that they need. And the idea that sometimes, and scope creep is an adequate word for this, we think we can go beyond something where we don't have the knowledge. Occupational health is a field and a profession. The occupational health professional is a profession on its own.
Yep.
But they come under the umbrella of occupational safety and health. And, you know, sometimes it's difficult for a corporate leader to be able to fathom what we're trying to explore right now, and to look at all of these different dynamics. I think one of the key issues, and if our friend Andrew was on the call with us, I think he would also say this. He can speak for himself at some point, but I think one of the key issues is leadership. And the idea of making sure that leadership is truly up to speed about the integration of occupational safety and health in everything we do. And the second key issue that is very much linked to leadership is the idea of the establishment of a safety and health culture, mm-hmm. where everybody on board, you know, the whole team on the ship is working together to make sure that the ship is safe. Mm-hmm. And it's not a question of, you know, someone saying, that's not your business, go away. It's more like saying, thank you very much. I appreciate the fact that you pointed this out to me. And having this kind of culture in place, having people work as a team to try to instill and to try to reinforce a strong standing safety culture becomes a very, very important tool on this journey. So part of the exploration that Stuart and I did were kind of looking from the optic of these perspectives at the seven different topics as we got into this paper.
Gents, I mean, that's really, really cool. And, you know, and I think, you know, from a culture perspective, I think we could talk about safety and safety cultures and where that fits into the culture of the business in quite a bit of detail. David Stuart, thank you so much for coming on the show. I just love listening to you guys talking about your history, your experience, your background, and just giving us a little bit of insight into the paper. I'm really excited about episode two, where we get into the nitty gritty of it. You know, really what it's what it's about. Why you put this paper together? Because you didn't start out, you know, thinking about this as a paper, but where you've taken it. And I think really, you know, what you're hoping people do with it. So, you know, that's coming up in the next episode. I'm really, really excited about that. I just want to have a little word from our sponsors. Project Meletium is an amazing community for health and safety professionals. If you're new to the profession or you want to start out in a profession, if you've been in a profession for a while and maybe hit a bit of a crossroads, or if you're towards the end of your career and you want to give something back, then Project Meletium is the place for you. So, you know, please check out www.projectmeletium, which is MOLLITIAM.com. You'll find out all the details, and we've got an offer where you can sign up for free for the first month. So please check out www.projectmeletium.com. We look forward to seeing you on some of the community calls. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Interest in Health and Safety podcast. You can follow and engage on Facebook and LinkedIn by searching the Interest in Health and Safety community, or go to www.influentialmg.com. And remember, let's make health and safety as important as everything else we do in business.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Colin Nottage.